Okay, Edward opened us with prayer here this morning, so we're going to dive right into our Bible study this morning. We'll see what we can get through. We're on green sheet. This is the third week on this. I don't know, I can't promise it'll be the last one, but it's the third week that we've been on this. And we've made it this far. How about that? That's pretty good progress. Any of you that have ever taught through this, you probably know exactly what I'm speaking about, because you can race through a number of verses on these things, but it's very important, I think, that we take our time and sit on some of these areas. And the reason I say that is because when I was 20 years old, the first time I really had somebody teach me the Christian life. Now, to put this in perspective, I was saved when I was 4. I grew up from the time I was 4 in a church very much like this one. Sat in Sunday school classes. I had my mom for a teacher in junior high. I had different people when I was in high school. And I sat in there, and we actually had a pastor that was a pretty good teacher. Really was, for the most part. For about 5 years. Before that and after that, not so good. But I didn't ever have... Really, the Christian life that I was taught growing up, and probably a lot of you were taught this, is that the secret to the Christian life is every day you should pray, and every day you should have some Bible reading. Quiet time. That's what we learned it in college. It was devotions when I was growing up, went up to college. Quiet time, okay? And this was the secret to the Christian life, and then you've got these things that you shouldn't do, and if you have a problem with these things, you should ask God maybe for help to not do these bad things. And that was kind of the essence of the Christian life. Oh, and witness. Oh, yeah, everybody's got to go out and witness. Yeah, we got to add that in there. But nobody ever sat down and said, you know what, you have a thing called the sin nature. Now, I heard I had a sin nature, but nobody ever explained to me, what does the sin nature look like? Why is it a problem? And then how do you deal with it other than just not doing those things? Just, I'm not going to be bad. I'm not going to do those things. And then there's Satan out there. And as far as I was concerned growing up, Satan and the sin nature was all the same bag. Every problem I had with the sin nature, they were all things from Satan. And hopefully what you have seen already and what we've been looking at here on Satan, we've already looked at the sin nature. We spent some time back a couple months ago looking at the sin nature. Now we're looking at Satan. And hopefully what you're seeing is that Satan comes along and his attack, his approach to addressing you and I, to attacking you and I, is not with the sin nature. And he is going to primarily use deception. And he's going to use deception and fear. Those are his two biggest tools in his arsenal. Now, we also have scriptures that tell us that he has, literally we have the word cunningness, is the English word we have, but the word cunningness literally meant all works. So as I've told you before, it's as though he's got a whole tool belt. And it's like, oh, that one won't work with this guy, but this one will. And he pulls this tool out. And I've got this tool for this job. In other words, he has the right tool for the right job to attack you and I. Now, most of those attacks are going to fall in the area of deception and fear. But there's a lot of different ways that deception and fear come on. And just reviewing what we've had, we've seen that with fear, he uses to get us agitated and to distract us from the things that God wants us to do. So we're moved by fear. He might use intimidation to intimidate us, to keep our mouth shut and not say what we should say when it should be said. And that particularly had to do with communicating the gospel. He might use a fear of death in that. We looked at some examples of using the fear of death. There's other types of fear that can come. Think about that. Most of us don't live in fear of death when it's communicating the gospel. We fear maybe a little bit of ridicule. We fear being snubbed. We might fear somebody giving us the cold shoulder and never wanting to talk to us again, ruining a friendship, things like that. Those are the things we fear. I don't ever remember fearing that I was going to die for sharing the gospel with anybody, ever that I can remember. There are believers that do, very really are in that situation today, but that's not ours. And from that, there are doubts arise. There's deception and fear that, oh, if I don't keep a Sabbath day, then I'm out of favor with God. Or if I eat this meat that maybe was offered to an idol, I'm out of favor with God. Or if I take a drink of wine, I'm out of favor with God. And there's fear from those type of things. And so there's fear that Satan uses to make us doubt that certain things would be okay. You as a believer, let's just make it very clear, you as a believer do not have to keep a Sabbath day. You can, but you don't have to. You as a believer could eat meat offered to idols. Paul talks about that. You as a believer could even, as long as you don't get drunk, you could even partake of wine. None of those things are forbidden you or required of you as New Testament grace believers. But if you doubt that, if Satan is making you doubt that that's okay, then acting on that and doing it, it becomes sin to you. And if you encourage somebody to do that while they're doubting, Paul tells us in 2 Corinthians, you are sinning also. So that's, we're just trying to help you see. See, there's a lot of different ways that this comes in the way Satan works in these areas. We started looking at pride last week and arrogance that goes with that and speaking against a brother. I've got most of these things that are underlined on your outline. And so we went through James. So a person says, you know, I'm going to move to this town and I'm going to start this business and I'm going to do this and I'm going to make a profit. And they never once say, God, is this what you want me to do? Do you want me to do this? I've got my agenda. I've planned this out. This should work. This is going to happen. You know, I'm on the, in 10-year time, I'm going to accomplish these things and this is where I'll be. And that's what that individual's doing. And we saw that in that, if you remember the example, the word that we used that he talks about, well, I'm not going to go back to it here, but it's a word that literally meant, it was like a snake oil salesman. It was this person to stand up there and boast and go on and go, oh, look at all these great things. This thing will cure all your ills. This will fix everything. And that was the word that he uses for a person that boasts like that. Because just like a snake oil salesman is going to sell you a bottle of something that's primarily whiskey or something in there with maybe a few herbs added in there to make you think that you're getting a good deal. It's like going to these nutsy nutrition stores today and you buy all their herbs and everything like that. And none of them have any demonstrable proof that it's going to, but people pay thousands of dollars a year buying into this snake oil thing. And all the great claims, this will cure everything. You're bald, it'll put hair back on your head. You know, things like that. You're weak, it'll turn you into a Samson. All this, you know. And it turns out to be nothing. It doesn't actually do what it claims. And that's the same thing with the person that decides they're going to go off and pursue this course of action and make this business and make all this money. Because he says, you don't even know what your breath is or what your life is. It's like a breath. Elsewhere in James, he says it's like grass. You know, you cut the grass. Think about that around here. You know what that's like in the summertime. You guys have to mow your lawn once a week, right? So the life of a blade of grass for you is a week. And then you chop that off. And you may bag it or let it just fall on the ground. But one way or another, about a week. What's that? And he says that's the way we ought to approach this. And then, in light of some of these things, then there also was another arrogant situation that we looked at in Romans 16 that goes back to the Romans 14 problem with people with days, eating foods and wine and other things that might come in there. And just to give you some ideas, because I did this in another Bible study. How about entertainment? I grew up in a church where you did not pay money to go to a movie. But everybody in my church owned a television with an aerial, and we all watched ABC, CBS, and NBC. Well, you know, that was sort of innocent. In fact, I think I remember Steve Adams talking about the fact that he grew up in a house where you could not go out and throw the football on Sunday afternoon, but it was okay to watch Tom Landry, who claimed to be a Christian, coach football on Sunday afternoons. And he always kind of wondered, how does that work, you know? But that's the whole thing. Is it acceptable to have a TV? I knew Christians. I knew a Christian. He was at a thing, heard, oh, Christians shouldn't watch television. And he came home, pulled out his wire cutters, walked over behind his TV and clipped the cord. And that was his solution to it. No more television in this house. We're not going to do this because it's all corrupt. And that's this whole thing that there are things that God hasn't given us absolute yes or no's on. And we as Christians tend to go to extremes. We're either all for it or all against these things. And that problem then, when you run roughshod over brothers that have those problems, Paul talked about that man, and this is where we ended last week, that he disregards those because he feeds his own belly. He's concerned about his own belly. And in being concerned for his own belly, he's more concerned for that than how it's going to affect you. I'm going to eat this whether it bothers you or not. Buck up. You've had enough time to grow up. I am not giving up my steak. And that's the kind of attitude. And he says, you need to watch for people like that in the church. You keep your eye on them. The idea is actually like putting a scope on them, scoping them out. Fine, there they are. I see them. I'm keeping my eye on that guy because that guy is nothing but trouble around here. And believers, those are believers. Now, I ended with something, and this is not on the outline. Therefore, we're probably going to take us not, we won't get through the rest of this outline today. Because I wanted just to point out a couple of things. At where we left off last week, that in Romans 16, if you'd turn back there for a minute. Romans chapter 16 and verse 20, when he's talking about these people that run roughshod over other believers. They do not follow this teaching. In the context, then, he makes a positive statement in verse 19 that he's positive that the Roman saints are going to make good choices in this regard. Most of the believers in the church will. But in verse 20 says, and the God then of peace, and I believe he calls him the God of peace because back in chapter 14, he's talking about you doing things with regard to other believers that make for peace rather than make for disunity, problems, making a distinction between the immature believer and the mature believer, and this one doing things that disregards the problems of the immature believer, and in so doing, disrupts peace. So the God of peace, then, the God that is the source of peace and the God that wants you to be at peace among yourselves. He wants us to be at peace. He doesn't want us, as Jim was talking in Sunday school class, he doesn't want us to grit it out by our teeth and I'm going to get along. I'm going to be at peace with this guy if it kills me. That's not what he's talking about. He's talking about peace that you get from God, peace that he gives you to be able to pursue peace with other believers. And he says, the God of peace will crush Satan under your feet in a short while. And we talked about that last week. What does he mean by this crushing Satan under your feet? If you turn back to, well, I want to look at two other verses first. We'll take these. Flip over to the book of Hebrews, chapter 10 for just a minute. Hebrews chapter 10. And when you get there, turn with me to verses 12 and 13. Because I really believe this crushing Satan under your feet is a twofold reference. Verse 12. It's talking about Jesus Christ, about the normal priests, they had to deal every day with things. But verse 12, but he, referring to Jesus Christ, having offered one sacrifice for all time, once and for all, sat down at the right hand of God, waiting from that time onward until his enemies are made a footstool for his feet. An image which we can appreciate, but it's not part of our culture. We don't think of putting our enemies under our feet, but in their culture they would have understood that, about having enemies come up and literally kneel down in front of you to show their subservience. We, on the other hand, if we go off to war with you and we beat you and eventually they all sit down equally at chairs at a table across from each other and they sign papers and say the war has ended now, we defeated you and you recognize that. We don't take those guys that are defeated and humiliate them and say, you're going to stand out here and I'm going to put my foot on top of your head, which they did. Sometimes they would take the guy's head off and sometimes the king would simply put his foot on top of the head of the enemy to say, you're beaten. You see the power I have on you? My foot is on your head. And so it was an image they understood very well in their culture. We don't get it today as much, but they really understood this picture. This is repeated in the book of 1 Corinthians 15 where he tells us that one of those enemies is death. But notice it's enemies. Death is the last enemy, but there are other enemies to be defeated in the meantime. Now that's future. And if you turn over to the book of Genesis for a second, and I don't know if any of this occurred to any of you, but in Genesis chapter 3, there's a very interesting statement over here that probably most of you have read, you've seen, you've probably heard messages on this. But it says, God is talking with Adam and Eve, and he's addressing what happened with them in the garden, and he's also addressing the serpent. But remember, the serpent is a foil for Satan, because Satan has used the serpent to accomplish these ends. And we know that from the book of Revelation that tells us that Satan was that serpent of old. You'll never find Satan or devil in Genesis here. You just find the serpent. Satan or devil. I'm going to make sure I said that right. And in verse 15, as he is talking, in verse 14, we should actually go back. He's talking about the Lord God said to the serpent, because you have done this, cursed are you more than all cattle, more than every beast of the field. On your belly shall you go, and dust shall you eat all the days of your life. And I will put enmity between you and the woman, between your seed and her seed, and he shall bruise you on the head, and you shall bruise him on the heel. Now, what's worse, to be bruised on the head or to be bruised on the heel? To be bruised on the head signifies significant defeat. But in defeating him by a bruise to the head, he inflicts also a bruise on the heel. And the Lord Jesus Christ, of course, has accomplished that in defeating Satan. But in defeating Satan, Satan brought about his own defeat because he moved men to take Christ and put him on the cross and crucify him. And in that process, brought about his own defeat, not realizing that that's what he was doing. Does that have any resemblance whatever to what Paul's saying in Romans 16? The enemy is going to be crushed? I think it does. Now, there's one other statement in Genesis chapter 22. Genesis chapter 22. In Genesis chapter 22, we have a situation in which God has asked Abraham to offer his son Isaac on an altar. And he does this, and most of us, most of us look at that and we go, man, I don't know, have any of you ever reading that growing up or in church ever wondered, wow, that was really incredible on the part of Abraham that he was willing to do that? Now, the book of Hebrews tells us something you don't know from Genesis. Hebrews tells us Abraham, by faith, knew if he killed Isaac, God would raise him up because he knew Isaac was the son of promise. The book of Hebrews 11 tells that, but you'd never get that reading Genesis. If you just read this without the commentary that Paul provides in Hebrews 11, you wouldn't know this. But the other thing is this whole question about why would God even ask Abraham to do this? God actually was distinguishing himself from the false gods of all the other people, because most of you do not know this. I didn't really know this until we went through the Minor Prophets, and in studying the Minor Prophets, a number of other scriptures throughout the Old Testament that I'd read over the years all of a sudden made sense. Most of the gods of the other people in the Mediterranean, around that region where Israel was located, their gods required that you offer your firstborn son. The reason son was because that was your heir. Remember, your girls were never heirs. Only your men child and only the firstborn, that was your primary heir. And it was required that you offer that male child in sacrifice to their gods, killed and burned. In fact, as they've excavated in North Africa, where was the city that Hannibal was from? I can't think of it. City in North Africa, anyway, I'm sorry. As they've excavated there, they have found thousands upon thousands upon thousands of urns, ossuary urns, with the bones of infants that have been burned. Because that's what they did. And that's just in the excavations they've done. Starts with a C. I can't remember. Still, you guys would recognize the name. What? Carthage. Thank you. Carthage, yes. Carthage in North Africa. But this was Baal, where they lived around Baal. This is what they required. Baal required this. In fact, the altar of Baal was a god that sat with his arms out like this. And you'd bring your child, your firstborn child, and lay that baby up there, burn it, kill and burn it. That's horrid. But these people lived with that. And now God comes along and Abraham asks Abraham of this. And Abraham's probably thinking, hey, you know, all the other gods around here ask of this. And then God goes, in the end, this is not what I want from you. And he does this with Israel. I don't want your firstborn like this. I want you to buy your firstborn back from me. I don't want you to sacrifice him. God's distinguishing himself from these false gods. Anyway, That's all a little bit of an aside, but the thing is, where did those false gods get, where does that come from, offering your child with false gods? Who are we looking at? Satan. And this is what Satan does with the perverted twist that he brings with deception to religion, that you're thinking you're getting yourself better in with God by what? Killing your firstborn male child. I mean, what a horrible thing. It just shows you. Satan will pass himself off as your best friend when it's in his best interest, but he is not anybody's best friend. And so in this context, he offered his brother. Yeah, Cain went and killed his brother then out in the field. In Genesis 22, then, in this context, because Abraham does this, and all that was a little bit of a kind of a meandering away from the main point I wanted to get to, because Abraham does this, then God makes Abraham a promise. This is the fourth covenant God makes with Abraham. This is not a continuation of any other covenants, because Galatians tells us, once you make a covenant, you don't take away and you don't add to it. God makes four covenants at four times with Abraham, and they each have different promises. And this promise is distinct, and you better listen to this, because this is the one covenant to Abraham that specifically affects you. Paul tells us this in the book of Galatians. Okay, the other covenants are not direct, do not directly involve us. And so, in verse 15, and the angel of the Lord called to Abraham a second time from heaven. And he said, by myself then I have sworn. Now that's one of the reasons that we know this is the covenant that Paul refers to in Hebrews 6 and he refers to in Galatians 3, because both times he says it's a covenant God made by swearing an oath. God never did this on any other time. He only did this time. He says, I have sworn, declares the Lord, because you have done this thing and have not withheld your son, your only son. Indeed, I will greatly bless you. I will greatly multiply your seed as the stars of the heavens. Paul talks about that in Galatians. That's accomplished by the seed, interestingly enough, that Paul points out in Galatians is a singular seed, Paul says. It doesn't say many. It says one seed, and that seed is Christ. How do you have one seed that's multiplied? Paul tells you in Galatians 3, there's one person, Jesus Christ, and you, the believers of the church, are in him, so one becomes many. And he explains it. Just read Galatians 3. Paul tells you and explains it nicely. But he says, I will greatly multiply your seed as the stars of the heaven, as the sand which is on the seashore. That is not a promise to national Israel. That is a promise fulfilled with us. There is similar promises made with regard to national Israel. Not denying that. I'm just saying this one is not theirs. And your seed, singular seed in the Hebrew, shall possess the gates of, New American Standard says there, but it is not there, it's his. It's a singular pronoun in the Hebrew. His enemies. Possessing the gate of an enemy. If you could come to a city that was walled and you took possession of the gates of their city, you now controlled who could go in and come out. You controlled the enemy if you controlled the gates. You had defeated them. And this is what he's saying. Again, this is something you and I have to explain because we do not live in walled cities with gates. But this would be similar to the illustration Jesus used in the Gospels. If you're going to rob a man's house, you got to, first of all, as it were, you got to break down the front door and control the strong man of the house. If you've done that, you got it. Unless the wife's packing a .45 back in the bedroom or something. But anyway, that's neither here nor there. I'm sorry. Shouldn't get distracted with ridiculous things. Anyway, he possessed the gate of his enemies. That's talking about us. And I believe this is now, what we have then is a twofold fulfillment of this promise over this. And this is what Paul's referring to in Romans 16. Ultimately, this is fulfilled in Jesus Christ defeating Satan's world, and defeating death, which was brought by Satan, in the future. It's being fulfilled at moments in time when you and I actually take the victory Christ has won for us and live it out in a moment of victory by not letting Satan defeat us in this deception, these lies, using fear to make you hold your tongue when in reality God wants you to speak. Or when you run roughshod, being tempted to run roughshod over another brother, and you don't care about them. So think about that. You are given the privilege of actually living out in practice the victory Christ won by what he did on the cross and will ultimately fully take when he comes back in the future. You get the opportunity to live out a little bit of that right now. But that's true. Our brother Jim's been going over the rapture with us for the benefits, actually practical benefits of the rapture over the last several months. And looking at that, many of those benefits are you getting the privilege to live out right now some of the things that will be true of us after the rapture. You don't have to wait for the rapture for some of those things. You can be living those out now. When you live out the fruit of the Spirit, Christ-like character, that's living out in a moment in time what John tells us in 1 John, that we will be like him, for we will see him as he is. And the Spirit can give you the ability to be like him for a moment in time now. Not permanently right now, but at least for a moment in time. And likewise, here's an instance where Satan is going to be crushed under our heels if, as Paul said in verse 19, if these people really lived out the proper relationship to their brothers that they were to have. And Paul was confident that some of them would. Now, to move on with this, one of the other areas, and this goes right along with what we're saying here, is sometimes Satan uses pride to encourage us to be ungracious. And again, I think this goes under deception. We have it under pride, but this is pride with regard to deception. Because pride really is deception, isn't it? It's being deceived that something you've done or can do is really so great that somebody ought to pin a medal on your chest. I have a whole wall of medals for all the great accomplishments I've had for God. And that's the kind of mentality that runs through. God's lucky to have me on his team. So let's take a look at this passage in 2 Corinthians chapter 2. 2 Corinthians chapter 2. Now, to lay a little bit of a background here as we press into this, verse 6 sufficient for such a one is this punishment by the many. Now, to be honest, we really don't know for sure what Paul is talking about here, except that apparently somebody in the church was put under punishment by the rest of the church. We have a scenario in 1 Corinthians chapter 1 where we have a brother that is doing something he should not be doing, and the church has been arrogant that they can put up with this. Look at how tolerant we are. We are so tolerant. We can tolerate a brother doing these horrible things. He's in an incestuous relationship with his mom. Yuck. And he says, boy, the Gentiles don't even do this kind of stuff. And by that, that doesn't mean they never do, but it's not very normal, what he's saying. So if you stop and you understand that then Paul tells him, you put him out of the church. We'd look at today and a lot of churches today would go, well, we don't do that kind of stuff. That's for a bygone age. Hey, what Paul said in the first century would be true for us. If you've got a brother that's in a problem like this and it persists in there and he hasn't changed his behavior, Paul says you ought to put him out. And if that means you have to station a couple of men at the back door and he tries to come in and you say, are you done? Have you quit? And he goes, no. You're not welcome here. Leave. We look at that and go, well. And we'd say, that's not being gracious. Oh, so it's being gracious to let him persist in doing something that leaves a mark on the church? That's not being gracious either. It's being loving to tolerate this. This is like, I don't want to get off on this, but this is like this mentality. It's like parents that don't discipline their kids because that's not loving. And those are the same parents that I've had come to me when their kids are 16 years old and they're going, we can't do anything with Johnny. He's so rebellious. And I'm thinking, you should have done this when the kid was 5. But you were understanding and tolerant and you bred a monster. Well, this is what happens in the church when you just tolerate this kind of activity. It's not beneficial to them for him to think, hey, it's okay for me to be like this. I can live in this kind of a horrible relationship. It's not good for him. You're not doing him any favor any more than the parent that leaves the kid unpunished is doing the kid a favor. And so Paul says in verse 7, so then on the contrary, you should rather, now if you have most English Bibles, they're all going to translate this the same, forgive and comfort him, lest somehow such a one should be overwhelmed by excessive sorrow. Now I've translated this word because this is actually a causative form of the word grace. You need to be gracious with him. Being gracious is bigger than just forgiving him. And this is what Paul is saying. You need to be gracious with them and then encourage him. Does that include forgiveness? Yes, but forgiveness is too narrow. You need to deal some grace towards this guy. Same language that Paul uses at the end of 2 Corinthians or Ephesians chapter 4. And again, they translate it forgive because I don't think that they understand what Paul is getting at when he's using this term grace. Probably because primarily the church has understood the grace of God very poorly in its history. Okay. But Paul goes on from here then in verse 7. He says that you should be gracious with him, I would say, and comfort or encourage him, lest somehow such a one be overwhelmed by excessive sorrow. In other words, that would be akin to a parent doing the right thing. Johnny does something wrong, mom and dad discipline him, whatever that discipline may be. Stand in the corner, timeout, spanking, whatever it might be, mom and dad discipline him. But then when the discipline's over, mom and dad go, stand in the corner another 10. Another 15. The rest of the day. Now, maybe sometimes Johnny did something that's worth standing there the rest of the day. I probably was like that as a kid. But this is talking about now the next morning the kid gets up, comes down to breakfast, and mom and dad say, in the corner! And the point would be, now it's becoming excessive. The point of discipline is to deter a child from doing the wrong thing. The point of discipline on the part of the church with somebody that's not doing living that right is to encourage them to quit, to make their activity unpleasant to them, to give them, as it were, an unpleasant consequence. But once they've experienced the unpleasant consequence, you've got to give them a chance to find out now, have they learned from the lesson or are they going to repeat this? If they repeat it, then it can go back to the corner. But if you just keep them in the corner, you're never giving them a chance to ever find out, have they learned their lesson? So, Paul says then in verse 8, wherefore I urge you to then reaffirm your love to him. And for this end also I wrote, that I might put you then, he says here, to the test. I want you to prove something. This is a good test. Whether you are obedient then in all things. For whom you are gracious with anything, I also. For indeed what I have been gracious with, I have been gracious for them. For your sake in the presence of Christ. And that brings us to verse 11, where he says, in order that Satan should not take advantage of us, for we are not ignorant of his schemes. We'll talk about these two things down here, verse 11. This word that's take advantage of, is that this verb is the same word for covetousness. And it comes from this word here, which means more, and then this word, ekte, which comes from the Greek verb echo, which means to have. Covetousness means to have more. When you covet, you want more than you have. We just looked a couple weeks ago at what Paul says over in Hebrews 13, where Paul says, be content with the things that are present. You say, I'm content with the things that are present as long as tomorrow I get something else. That's not content. And Satan wants more. And so they translate this to take advantage of. And I don't think that that's horrible translation, but the idea is Satan wants more. And he's going to take more. And he's going to take you to get more. And he says that's going to happen by Satan. For we are then, he says, not ignorant of. And they translate this schemes. But this word right here is the word mind in this ending is the things of the mind. And it's literally the results. This ma, those two letters right here, mean results, and then this is the things. In other words, we're not ignorant of what Satan does with our minds to mess up the output. What's the output of the mind? What you say, how you react, what you do. And he says, we know Satan wants to get advantage of us, and Satan does not want you to exercise grace towards other people. He does not want you to do that. Because he wants to mess up your thinking and going, That guy burned his bridges. That's it. It's over. No more chances. Again, what does Satan move us to oftentimes to do? To go to extremes. Either we drink no wine, or we guzzle wine till it's coming out our ears. We're a vegetarian, Romans 14, or we eat meat seven times a day. Seven times a week. I'm addled. Okay. I'm Sabbath. How many of you ever read Little House on the Prairie? How many of you ever read Little House in the Big Woods? That's what I should refer to. Because in Little House in the Big Woods, Laura writes in there about her father that when Sabbath day came around in her father's generation, what did the kids do? They had to sit against the wall all day. Could you imagine making your kids sit all day against the wall during Sabbath day? I mean, you did nothing. But that's showing, see, that's an extreme. We're going to do nothing. We're going to sit all day. Just sit. Versus over here, well, there's no day, and there's Christians today that are like, I don't need to go to church because I'm not under law. I don't need to go to church. Well, Paul's not saying you don't have to keeping a day means you don't have to go to church. You still need time with saints. To think you don't need to be with other believers is also deceiving. See, Satan moves us to extremes. So what are the two extremes here? The extreme number one is actually in 1 Corinthians. We tolerate this guy. Look at, we can put up with, we've got, you want to know how tolerant we are? We've got a guy here that's living with his mom. That's extreme one. Extreme number two, we put him out, he's never coming back. In the time we've pastored here, sadly, I've had three individuals, one officially and two that I just personally, one officially that we asked not to come to church, and two that I told them, I didn't tell them they couldn't come, but I told them, I said, I don't know why you want to come if you don't want to do what the Word of God says, because you're not. And they never came back. I said, I just don't get it. Why you want to be here if you don't want to put into practice what the Word of God says? It's like you want to learn it, but you don't want to live it. And I knew in both those situations that if those people persisted to come and didn't change their behavior, we were going to have to act on it. I was just trying to encourage them, hopefully, that they would change their behavior, which I did do that in the context. But see, I could have said with both of those individuals, hey, you change it, come back, we want you back. And I tried to indicate that to them. But you know what? All three of those individuals, if any one of them would walk through the door and said, you know what, I did was wrong, I'm done. I'm done with that. I'd say, have a seat. I'd love to see any of those three individuals come back. I'm glad it's only been three. I wish there weren't three. But it has happened in the 21 years that we've been here. Three times I've had this happen. And I'd love it if they could come back and sit down. But Paul says, Satan here takes advantage of us so that we don't want to be gracious. So that we in our minds are like, that's it. And he leads us astray. And he knows that we have a tendency to go to extremes. And so he tempts us to go that way. Everybody follows this? So you have the ability to put on the armor of God. We haven't talked about the armor of God, but most of you have been through the armor of God with us before. You have the ability to put on the armor of God, and when you do, you can defeat Satan from leading you astray in this manner to have this harsh attitude towards a brother in which you will not tolerate him in any way. And in not tolerating, you put him out, you never want anything to ever do with him ever again. Now, there are some tough things back in 1 Corinthians. Paul says, you know, if there's a brother that's living like that, you put him out. He says, you don't even eat with those brothers. Really? You don't invite him over for supper? No, don't invite him over for supper. You see him downtown at the cafe? You don't go over and sit down by the table. Paul says, you don't do that. Because, see, that's fellowship. You're sharing something in common. You're sharing a meal in common. You're sharing that time in common. And Paul says, you don't extend that to them when you put them out. But you could go overboard and say, they're my enemy. They are not your enemy. In fact, when he actually talks to them about some believers over in 2 Thessalonians that were taking advantage of the situation, he says, you don't treat them like enemies, however. You don't eat with them, but you don't treat them like enemies. And I have one of these individuals I do bump into from time to time, and I do say hi. I even talk maybe about his kids, but I don't sit and get chummy, chummy, chummy. Anyway, okay. Next one that goes on from there. Pride that involves stealing and rotten speech. Two things. Over in Ephesians chapter 4. Ephesians chapter 4. And I actually want to go back up to verse 26 because I believe verse 26 ties in with this. Verse 26 brings in an aspect of a work of the flesh. Because it says in verse 26, be angry, and yet do not sin. Do not let the sun go down on your anger. And the word anger literally is provocation. Because here's, if you can see those letters, that's our word for fury or anger. And you can see those right there. And then this literally means something that comes in beside the anger. So you're angry, and now something comes in and settles up beside the anger that provokes it, pushes it on beyond even what was acceptable. And by the way, we've been over this before. This is an imperative. Be furious. And we're going, why would Paul say, be furious, be angry? But I believe Paul is using what we might call, what in Greek grammarians referred to as an imperative permission. Paul said, okay, you want to be angry? Go ahead and be angry, but don't sin. And there's an important statement that James makes that the wrath of God, the wrath of man, this word, does not produce the righteousness of God. Something a lot of Christians could really stand to learn these days, because there's a lot of Christians that are really angry about a lot of stuff. And they think that we need some more righteous anger in our churches. And if we'd get angry, we could get our churches cleaned up and our country cleaned up and on and on and on and our families cleaned up. And Paul's saying, be angry, but don't sin. In fact, don't let something sidle in alongside your anger as the day goes to a close. Most of you probably could testify, if you go to bed angry, there's a chance you might wake up angry. And he then goes right into the very next statement in verse 27. He says, do not give the devil an opportunity, the New American Standard says. Literally in the Greek, don't give him a place. Don't give a place to the devil. In other words, being angry and hostile like this is like standing here and opening up a place and saying, Satan, right here. Here's a good foothold. Here's a handhold. Settle down right here. And so he's telling you, you end the day mad, you are opening yourself up to satanic attack. And the reason I say that is because, see, anger is a work of the flesh. Do you think Satan has an idea when you're mad? Even if you're not fuming. He's been watching you long enough. He's been watching you from the time you were a little guy. Satan right now, I can tell you, Satan is watching Joanna and he's watching Brooklyn. And he already has kind of figured out aspects of their own personalities at a year old. And he's able to measure those. And by the time those girls are two, he's really going to know them well. And by the time they hit 20, if they reach 20, if the Lord hasn't returned for us before then, he is going to know them like the back of his hand. And he's going to say, they right now are ticked off. There are some people that get angry and you can't see it. It's not obvious to you unless you know that individual. I've been married to my wife now going on 28 years. And there are times that I can tell when she's upset with me. And it's not because she's sitting across the room going. It's just that I know. I've watched your character. Now, it took me a few years because I'm a little clueless. There are times it took me a while to kind of figure things out. There are times I could tell that something was upsetting her. Took me a while to figure that out. But you know that. If you've been married any length of time, you have kids, you, after a while, you figure things out about character. Satan's way better at this than us. So you go to bed with something that's coming alongside your anger, and he tells us, don't give a place to the devil, because he's going to take advantage of that, and he's going to further tempt you. What does he say in verse 28? One of the things that is tied to Satan, goes along with pride and lying, is the one that steals, let him stop stealing. Let him labor. And I was like this. Let him labor, working with his hands for that which is good, that he might have to give or to share with those who are in need. He doesn't say work to take care of his own need. He says, even work so you have something to give to somebody else. In other words, it's getting the look off of you onto others. Something Satan doesn't want you to be other-minded unless it's picking at their character or something like that. He doesn't want you in a positive way thinking about how you can positively be used in other people's lives. He doesn't want you to think that way. But that, you know what? You go to bed angry. I know Dwight's going to be gone. He's going to take a trip. And Dwight kind of gets me steamed. And I go to bed angry and Satan's going up. You know what? Dwight's got that tool that you'd really like and he'll never miss it. Just help yourself to it while he's gone. He'll come back. I bet he'll just think you misplaced it. You don't think Satan works like that? He's going to help you justify the fact that I get mad at somebody else, and he's going to help me, through that anger, justify my actions of stealing. So it's not by accident that we have the rage issue up here, with Satan then taking advantage of us, followed by an issue of stealing. Now, that's not saying everybody that steals is stealing because they're mad at somebody else. That's not always the case. Some stealing is because people are deceived into thinking they're justified in doing it because, well, I'm hard up and they're okay, so it's not going to hurt them. But notice the other thing goes on and says in verse 29. In addition to stealing, he says, and let no unwholesome word proceed from your mouth. And the word that's translated unwholesome is this word sapros. Jim went over some words on kalos this morning in his adult class. And one of those, we had sapros was the opposite. And one of them, he didn't go to the verse. And I nabbed his class for a second there because I had been looking at the word for this. In Matthew 13, Jesus Christ talks about fishermen taking a net and pulling fish in, and they throw the good fish, the kalos fish, into the vessel, and the sapros fish they throw away. Now, to be real honest, I've read about this, and I don't know if by sapros fish he meant fish that you could look at and go, oh, that's an icky fish. Oh, that's a good fish. Oh, that's an icky fish. I don't know that that's, because really sapros was a word that was used several times by Jesus in the Gospels of a tree that is rotten that produces bad fruit or sapros fruit versus a kalos tree that produces kalos fruit, good fruit. Fruit that's noticeably good. You all know what noticeably good fruit is because you've all bitten into an apple that tastes like cardboard and you've all bitten into an apple that tastes like an apple. Same thing, use the illustration. We, Peg and I, several years ago had some friends, none of you because these people aren't even around here anymore. They'd gone fishing at Banks Lake in late August. They came down and they said, we caught more trout than we can catch. We already filleted them. Here's some trout fillets. And they brought us some late August Banks Lake trout fillets. Yeah, Terry's doing it right over there. I'm telling you, those were the muddiest, nastiest, fishiest tasting fish we've ever eaten. Peg cooked it all up. We each took about two or three bites and was like, oh. And we had to throw that. Well, I think we put it out back and let the cats eat it. Our cat wouldn't even eat it. The neighbor cats, I think, cleaned up the plate, but our cat didn't even care for it. It was really bad. Sapros. The thing was, that trout, when you looked at that trout fillet, if I would have seen that trout, you're looking at trout fillet, I'm thinking, oh, we're going to trout fillets. I don't know that it's good or bad. It looks good to me. Looks like other trout fillets I've seen. Didn't taste good. It was sapros. Same thing. How do you ever picked up an apple and you look at it and you go, that apple should look good. And then you eat it and it doesn't taste good. See, sapros means that it may have an appearance on the outside that it's a good thing, but at its core, it's rotten. And he ties this in here when he says in verse 29, do not let any, New American Standard says unwholesome, but this sapros is rotten at its core. These words rotten at their core not proceed out of your mouth. When I grew up, I thought that was cussing. I thought that was the four-letter words. I didn't realize that this is what we Baptists do. Because we Baptists don't utter four-letter words, right? Right? Well, where I grew up, we never did. I think I used not even a four-letter word. I just used what I've told my wife this once. I used a word once, and I ended up sitting on the edge of the bathtub with a bar of soap in my mouth for about 10 minutes one evening, one Friday night. I used a word. This is when I was about 10 years old. We just didn't talk like that. My parents didn't talk like that. I didn't. But you know what? We say things that are hard and mean and cruel to other people's character. We say things that hurt other people. We take jabs at their character, at the things they do. And on the outside, there's an air of respectability. But inside, it's rotten. See, Satan's no dummy. He's not going to come along and tempt a Christian and say, "Hey, Ed, I want you to teach your kids every four-letter word in the book." Ed's not going to do that. But he might tempt Ed. I'm not saying Ed's going to is one that would go down this path particularly, but we all are susceptible to this. He might be more inclined to come along and tempt him. But you know, Tim did this. And you know, I think it's about time you say something about it. But you don't want anybody to feel ill on you, so this is the way we're going to say it. And everybody else will think Ed's a nice guy. I should make it. I'll be me. I'll be the bad guy, not Ed. I'll say this thing, and it'll hurt him. And it'll hurt him bad. But everybody else, yeah, they'll be okay with it. That's his sapros. He says, don't let those kind of things go out of your mouth. Rather, those things which are good for edifying. Obviously here, the sapros are things that do not edify. And by edify, it's a word we get edifice from, which meant to build something, to build a structure. So it's the difference between words that build a structure up, lay the bricks in place, put the 2x4s in place, frame the walls and the siding, versus coming up there in a word that essentially is like taking a sledgehammer and plowing away at the work. That's a sapros. And again, it's something that comes from Satan. And it comes from, I think, if you go back up here to this provocation, I think it's tied in with the provocation. Something's coming alongside. You've gone to bed. You are steaming mad inside your head about this person and this thing, and you don't let go. I know families that 20 years, two brothers have not talked. Their kids have gotten in touch, but brothers won't talk because something was said 20 years ago. In fact, I actually knew kids of one of the families that one of these brothers showed up, that one of the kids in the family were like, "We didn't even know we had an uncle." Because something had passed between these people that was such bad blood, and on the one side, they would not let go of it for all these years. They wouldn't let go of this thing. And 20 years later, the kids of the one family didn't know about the uncle and his family. It just shows you. They can go to extremes. They can go to extremes. And so Paul here is telling us this is, don't give a place to Satan in these things. In fact, I would even go so far as if we went on even down to verse 30, he says, don't grieve the Holy Spirit. You're grieving him because back to the first part of Ephesians 4, he's trying to produce unity and you're trying to produce disunity by holding people at bay. And you're holding them at bay by the way you act towards them, by the way you think, and by what you say with these sapros words, and it holds them off. And in connection with that, then in verse 31, and let all bitterness, as well as then we have our two different words for anger here, anger and hot anger, or wrath and anger, and clamor and slander, let all those things be put away with malice. See, Satan tempts us that we're justified in having holding out on this bitterness. We won't let go. We won't let go. And we hold on to this thing and we won't quit. And you know what? Most of you are aware, I've been dealing with a situation, and some of you too, with a situation where one individual's been wronged by another individual, and the one individual just, when you talk with them, they just pour forth so much bitterness. They spew bitterness from what has happened to them. And I've tried to encourage this individual, you know what, you need to let it go. Because you're actually letting this other person win by the fact that you're letting them ruin your life. You don't have to be like this. You as a believer know how you could let go of this thing. In fact, I've walked this individual through the armor of God on numerous occasions. And we will eventually go through the armor of God here in a couple of weeks. But verse 32, the right response that he gives is that you should be kind to one another. Remember kind, the idea of being non-abrasive, to being the kind of person that makes others comfortable to be around you rather than making them edgy because you're always on edge and they're always worried about setting you off. They're always worried about pushing the wrong button accidentally. And be tender-hearted towards one another. Tender-hearted means compassionate. Literally, it was the good gut feeling that you have, compassion. And then we have our word gracious again that we had earlier. Being gracious to yourselves as also God has been gracious with you. Remember, bigger than forgiveness. Bigger than an issue of forgiveness. So you as an I as a believer, we didn't get through a lot more today, but again, I don't want to rush through these things because, as I said, as I've been going back through and studying these things, I'm realizing there's aspects of Satan's attack that sometimes I have kind of been blind to because I haven't always taken the time to look at him in terms of his deception. And here, looking at what we're seeing today, is that some of us having that mentality that I am justified in holding grace from this individual. I don't have to treat this person this way. I can be hard and tough towards them. They deserve it. They got it coming to them. Or as we saw there, Satan taking advantage in both those situations, both in 2 Corinthians and in Ephesians. You know how many believers there are? I grew up in a church where there had been a split. Years before I ever came there, we showed up in 1969 at that church. That church had split in the 40s. Over 20 years ago, had split from another Baptist church. The people in the other Baptist church, guess what? They were believers. And we were believers. You know how big the town was? 400 people. Two Baptist churches in a town of 400 people, and those churches had split, and there were some people in our church that still would not shake hands and talk with people from the other church, because those people would not pull out of the Northern Baptist Convention when it was time to pull out, even though they were brothers. They wanted to hold on and see if they could do something positive. And so the churches split, and you had brothers that wouldn't get along. And you look at that, this whole mentality. In other words, what I'm trying to tell you is, those people over there, we're already satanic. We're great. And there were people that were living in that church in denial of the fact that they were holding on to a problem that had lasted over 20 years. In fact, most of the people in the church, most of them by the time I was older, were kids when that happened. But they were still holding on to what happened, and mom and dad were involved in it, so I'm holding the line. And they weren't even a part of the original problem. Because most of the older people that were involved, they all died off within the first 5 years we were in the church, almost all of them. Because all of them were quite a bit older at the time. The ones that had been involved in this. So I'm going over this to help you see. Hopefully, I'm not intentionally trying to make you dredge through your life and find all the crud and junk. But I'm trying to help you see, hopefully in going through this, if there's an area of satanic attack you are dealing with, hopefully you'll see it. Hopefully God will bring this to your attention and you'll go, oh, look at that. I deal with that. Every week I deal with that area, or regularly I deal with that problem. That's a satanic attack. I didn't know what was going on. I just didn't think it was a great thing, but I didn't know it was a satanic attack issue. And so we're going to continue working through the rest of these things. We're going to pick up with Ananias and Sapphira and what happened with them and go through these. We'll come back and we'll do this, and eventually then we will walk through the armor of God and we'll look at how God has given you the ability to actually stand and resist Satan rather than being one that's run over and crushed and laid out there, left in the dust behind his attack. We don't want to go that path. Father, we are thankful for the time that you give us together, and we're thankful for your word. We don't get joy out of looking at problems that people have, but you know, we do get joy out of the fact that you point out these things so we don't have to keep going through them. That you actually have made it possible for us to actually have victory, to resist Satan. That we rejoice in. And yet we can't resist him if we don't know what he's doing, if we don't recognize his attack, because we don't resist him every day. We resist him when he attacks. Your word is plain on this. And so we're thankful then for your word. Even those passages that make us look at these conflicts, these areas of problem, this deception that he brings. You are truth. You are truth in every aspect of your being. Satan,
there is no truth in him. He is a liar and he is the father of the lie. And help us not to be those that buy into that lie, that we can do this without you. There is no way on this planet that we can do anything of any worth or value apart from you. And we're thankful for that reality. Help us to recognize that in our own lives. Thank you for the time together now and for the opportunities in the remainder of this day then. Amen.